It was all right. It was okay. It was all part of what was supposed to happen. It was all right. It was okay. It was all part of what was supposed to happen. She repeated it to herself 50 times. The studio apartment she found was small, and the 2 single-paned windows were no doubt drafty, and the rent would eat 60% of her income, but she didn't need much. A yogurt for breakfast, an apple for lunch. Often, she was able to take food from the nursing home. The cook was always giving away the stale bread, the milk that had reached its date but was perfectly fine. Fruit cups full of sweet syrup that would have to be thrown away after they reached a resident's tray, even if the resident hadn't so much as touched the tinfoil tab of the seal. The studio was walking distance to her doctor's office, though it meant a longer commute to the nursing home. A long commute seemed like something other people would mind, but Anne really didn't. The drive to and from work gave her something to do, and it was a way of filling more of the day. A television would help, but it seemed extravagant. She would wait. Dr. Oliver was no Dr. Abbasi, but Anne liked him okay, and he said she was doing very well. Since arriving at Irene, she'd been going for a blood draw every week to make sure she wasn't toxic, and only 1 single time since being discharged from the hospital, after a brutal stomach virus that left her dehydrated and weak, did she feel the familiar agitation bearing down on her. Margaret found her in the common room at 3 o'clock in the morning. She'd been watching a game show on TV, and when the players buzzed, Anne slapped the particle board coffee table and shouted the answers. When Margaret appeared, Anne commanded her to watch closely and tell her if it seemed as if one of the contestants was cheating. Margaret led Anne to her room and said good night, but the next morning, bright and early, she was knocking on Anne's bedroom door. "Get up," she said. "Get dressed, you're going to see the doc." Once Anne and Dr. Oliver were alone, something told Anne to keep her lips sealed until she was out of there, to refuse to say a single word. They stared each other down, and then Dr. Oliver told her gently that she'd be admitted to the local hospital for just a few days until the adjustment he was about to make leveled out. Anne thrust her wrists out to be cuffed. "No. No cuffs, Anne," he said. "You haven't done anything wrong." She'd keep her job, he promised. She'd be okay. There was no reason they shouldn't keep this one challenging week private. She'd been doing remarkably well. It occurred to her as she jiggled the lock of her new home that somewhere, not terribly far away, Peter was likely graduating from college. She hadn't taken comfort in the idea of him living with George, but at least she knew where he was. When he went to college, he felt farther away because he was in a different state. But again, at least she knew where he was. But now that he was graduating, it was May, cherry blossoms coated the sidewalks of Saratoga and felt like velvet underfoot. She imagined him like a top spun loose across a board, zigging and zagging wildly across the contiguous United States, Canada, Mexico. She studied the college students on the streets of town, walking billboards for Colgate and Bucknell and Syracuse, home on break for summer. She studied the boys in particular, and tried to make herself understand that Peter was now as old as these boys, these young men. He was the same age as his father had been when Anne met him. By September 1999, not knowing where he lived felt like an itch she couldn't scratch. Maybe he'd gone to Dubai, or Russia, or China. She'd read that a lot of businessmen had to be willing to travel and put in their time in foreign countries these days. Maybe he was somewhere on the other side of the world, speaking Japanese. She could call George. He'd tell her anything she wanted to know. "Why don't you?" Dr. Oliver asked. Because it would be one more thing, she wanted to shout. One more goddamn thing. All this weekly talking, and it was as if he'd never heard a single word she said. "I miss Dr. Abbasi," she said, instead of answering his question, hoping to stir some professional jealousy. In mid-October of that year, the doorsteps of Saratoga County, made festive with pots of mums and jack-o'-lanterns, Anne stopped at the same gas station she always used, but on this day, hanging in the window of the small storefront catty corner to where she was standing, was a sign: Private Detective, Discretion Guaranteed. At different times, that same storefront had housed a psychic, a therapist, a tax preparer. Now this. She jogged across the road while her car was filling and just walked by, at first, taking one quick glance at what was within. She turned and passed again. By her third pass, a man had opened the door. He barely came up to her nose and had a paper napkin tucked into the collar of his shirt. She just wanted to know, was all. She wasn't ready to hire anyone or anything. How much did it cost, anyway? Just an address would be fine, she said, in case there were different prices for different levels of information. If she were handy with the internet, like the young nurses at the home, this might be something she could find herself. One of these days, Anne planned on asking the nice one, the fat one named Christine, how to open an email account. Anne told the little man everything except the reason she didn't know where her son was. She wrote him a check for $100 because it seemed safe enough. The balance wouldn't be due until he got her the information she wanted. But almost as soon as she was back in her car, driving off to work, she began to feel like a prize idiot. He'd probably collect $100 from 100 idiot women that week, and then he'd pack it in and take off for a new location. But she didn't call the bank to stop payment on the check. It took him only 2 days to get back to her, and the price was far cheaper than she'd braced herself for. He told her that if there was anything else she needed, anything else she wanted to know, to just be in touch. But what she wanted to know was whether he was doing okay, whether he was happy. If he wasn't happy, if he wasn't doing okay, what would she be able to do about it? Take him back to her 300-square-foot apartment to live with her? These were things the man couldn't answer. He handed over a manila folder, and she took it home and left it in the middle of her bed and avoided looking at it as she heated soup for dinner. Finally, when there was nothing left to do, she opened it. On top, a typed address. Info about the building, how much his apartment cost to rent. The name and phone number of the management company. After that, a photo of the building. After that, a photo of him, walking. Something in his hand. A backpack on one shoulder. The photo showed Peter from a distance of maybe 50 feet, zoomed from an even greater distance. Anne brought her nose to the photo, tried to see him more closely, tried to breathe him in. This young man who was the baby she'd pushed out nearly 22 years ago. He was silent, too, at first, like his brother. And after 1 second of silence, 2 seconds, 3 seconds, the nurses huddled over him, their faces screwed tight as they handled him with alarming bluntness. 4 seconds, 5 seconds, 6 seconds. She let her head drop back to the pillow and accepted what she felt sure they were going to tell her, that this one would end like the last, only more cruelly because last time they'd been warned, at least, had time to prepare. But then he'd arched his back and cried, his face purpling with the strength of his howls, and they placed him on her chest, pale from whatever viscous material was inside her, whatever he'd lived on those 40 long weeks. When she touched him, his body tensed against her hand. "You see that?" the delivery nurse said. "He's already trying to lift his head." "A strong baby," Anne said, and realized the vibrations she was feeling weren't coming through the bed, but from her own body, which was sobbing, heaving. She gritted her teeth to stop from shivering. "A very strong baby," the nurse said. She thought she'd be able to make it until that Friday, when she had off, But just an hour into her shift, she knew there was no way she could wait that long. So instead, she started feigning illness. It was a plan that took shape as she was making it happen. She coughed into her fist a few times. Third and fourth graders from local schools had been trickling in all morning to make small Halloween parades for the residents. They answered questions about their costumes and held out their bags for candy, which they realized quickly came from the nurse's station and not from any of the ailing souls who seemed perplexed by the small ghosts and skeletons, the witches and vampires. Anne put her palm to her own forehead when she felt sure people were looking. Eventually, she got noticed, and the charge nurse sent her home. She raced to the apartment to change, to brush her hair, and then she made straight for the throughway. It took 3.5 hours to get there. Amsterdam at 103rd Street. A yellow brick building. 6 steps up to the door. A broken light outside. What did she expect to see? Him, she supposed, more clearly than in the photo. Perhaps sitting on the stoop just as she pulled up. Perhaps he'd come walking down the street at the perfect moment, from the perfect angle, and she'd know by the set of his shoulders how he was. When he was a boy, 9, 10, that age when boys are dying to be older than they are, he suddenly stopped crying when he was upset, and instead would set his shoulders like he was pushing them apart to make them seem broader than they were. He'd put one foot after another in a way that scared her, that determination to keep going, that determination to not cry, no matter what. And while she knew his intention was to seem older, he always, always seemed younger instead. It should have been enough to draw her out of herself, seeing the extraordinary effort a boy made to be okay, but it wasn't enough. Some days she could put her hands on those small shoulders and steer him around to look at her, to make him understand that she was his mother and she loved him, even if she didn't always say the words. But other times, times when he'd all but press his face against hers to get her attention, times when he'd kneel on the floor beside her bed and hold his grubby finger beneath her nose to check for breathing, it was impossible for her to even so much as open her eyes. But the worst times of all were when she punctured his strength on purpose, just so she could see whether it was possible for those shoulders to wilt, to see if there was a limit to what he could handle. "I regret having a child," she said to him once, for no reason at all, as he was doing his homework. "Greatest regret of my life." It was quiet in the kitchen, just the two of them, Brian on an overnight tour. There were 2 potatoes baking in the oven, the house full with the earthy scent of roasting skins. Peter was about 10 at the time, maybe 11, and still, a decade later, she could see the way the white oval of his face had snapped up in surprise. He'd looked right back down at his homework page as if it hadn't happened, but she could see in his posture that she'd thrown him, that where before he was concentrating in earnest, now he was just pretending. The tips of his fingers were white where he was gripping the pencil. The lead point hovered above the page. It had taken her a long time to tell Dr. Abbasi about that moment. Her absolute worst. Worse even than the time she smacked him. Worse than shooting Francis Gleason in the face. And whenever she glimpsed that moment, it came to her at any time without warning, and always felt like a punch in the mouth. She wondered if it was possible that she had none of these things the doctor said she had. Paranoid personality disorder, schizophrenia, schizoid personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, bipolar disorder. The diagnosis changed and morphed every year. New names for the same symptoms, but whether, in fact, she tricked them all, in a way, by going along, by taking the meds, by going to the sessions, tricked them the way Brian used to say she'd tricked him into getting married, into having a second baby, having Peter, when he'd never gotten over losing the first. She wondered if she was simply very, very mean. "I'll clean up," Peter said that long, terrible night, May 1991. looking around at the mess she'd made of the house. He was 14 already. Who could have predicted how that night would turn out? 5 more minutes, and she would have been too deeply asleep to hear the racket of Lena Gleason pounding on the back door. She'd taken a sleeping pill, a half dose. She'd cracked the pill in two by pressing it hard into the palm of her hand. It would have been Brian's problem to deal with, and they probably wouldn't have even told her about it. But when she walked to the window and looked down, there was Francis and Lena Gleason and their daughter standing in the light of the Stanhope's back step. There was Brian's long arm holding the screen door open. By the time she got downstairs, the Gleasons were gone. And Brian was telling Peter that he shouldn't have snuck out like that. But he was so half-hearted about it, so damn soft about it like he always was. And so Anne had walked up and belted Peter across the face. "That's for hanging around with that brazen girl in the first place," she said. "And that's for sneaking out." She tried hitting him a second time, but he dodged her, held his cheek, half turned to the wall like a child sent to the corner for punishment. And then she caught a look on Brian's face. Disgust, yes, but also a confirmation of the thing he'd announced already, but was maybe still unsure about. So although her head was splitting and she felt so unbelievably tired, she turned to him and started up once again with the argument they'd been having for weeks. He wanted to take a break. He wanted to do some thinking, alone. She thought of the morning she told him that the baby was dead. She hadn't seen the doctor yet. She just knew. No movement at all for more than 24 hours. A dull ache across her back. She knew in the shower. She knew as she sipped her tea. She knew as the wind stirred the odors of the sidewalk below their first floor window. They were still in the city then, and blew them into the room where they were standing, getting ready to head out to work. So she told him what she knew, told him how she knew it. But Brian poured cereal into a bowl, told her she didn't really know. No, not really. Only the doctor could tell them. And then, a few hours later, when the doctor did tell them, Brian had looked at her like he was looking at her now, like she'd done it, she'd made it happen, by just saying the words out loud. The night she shot Francis Gleason, she hadn't been feeling well for a long time, but she only realized that later. For months, conversations were drowned out by static, and she found herself having to speak louder, listen harder. She lost track of what people were saying. She lost track of what she was saying, and sometimes heard herself speaking as if from across a room. Physical movements were becoming more and more difficult, like trying to swim through a vat of wet cement. But these were symptoms she only noticed after the static quieted, after the cement drained away. "It's mostly like that for everyone," Dr. Abbasi said. "Everyone like her," he meant. It was impossible to have sufficient detachment at the most dangerous times. This was his way of saying she had to forgive herself. But there were other times, rare times, but still they happened, when the fact that she didn't feel well settled in her thoughts easily, clearly, like a sentence typed on a piece of paper slipped under her door. "Brian," she'd said one morning, not long before everything happened. It was a typed sentence morning, perfect clarity. She could see herself in vivid color, high definition. They were still in bed. It was raining hard outside, and every time a car passed on Jefferson, she could hear the water whipping under its wheels. What was she going to say? That she knew she made things hard? That she'd try that doctor again? The one who'd given her the prescription after she went into Food King with a gun? But before she could say anything, she saw him wince. She put her hand on his arm. She said his name, and he winced. Kept his eyes closed, even though she knew he was awake. Kept his eyes closed, even though he was terrible at pretending. And as she watched his eyelids flutter, she had to fight the strong desire to poke him hard in each one, to blind him. Peter wanted to take care of everything, all the time. That terrible night, as she and Brian argued, Peter bent to pick up the lamp she'd knocked over. He crawled around on his hands and knees, picking up magazines and mail, and the little wicker basket that had held them, and the figurines that had been lined up on the mantel before she flung them. The lights were on at the Gleasons. The lights were on at the Maldonados. She imagined all of Jefferson Street crouched outside in the dark, listening. She called Brian every name she could think of, and then she turned to Peter and used all the names again. She used words she couldn't stand to hear other people say. Faggot. Fairy. Cunt. Why? She didn't know. Still, no matter what name she called him, Peter kept that blank expression plastered to his face. Why was he so sure she didn't mean it? It was hazy, then, what happened next. Even in the privacy of her own mind, not remembering felt cheap, easy, and she tried to look closer, look more deeply, to discover whether she was being totally honest with herself and with the other people for whom it mattered. She did remember some things, but those memories were of a poor quality, like someone had smeared Vaseline on the lens. She remembered pressing the heels of her hands to her mouth and biting down. She remembered tasting blood on the tender inner part of her lower lip. The police said there was a kitchen chair pushed up to the fridge, no doubt so she could step up and reach the cabinet above. She couldn't remember pushing a chair across the room. She couldn't remember climbing on top. But she was the one who'd ended up with the gun, so it must have been her. "What do you remember?" the district attorney and another lawyer had asked her, their faces full of skepticism. She remembered the girlish giggle she used to feel rising up in her whenever Brian disappeared into the kitchen after his tours. As if she didn't know exactly where his new spot was almost as soon as he picked it. He always emerged from the kitchen with a beer, as if that's what he'd been in there doing, finding and opening a beer. As if that would ever take him more than 2 seconds. "What do you remember, Anne?" they asked her. Two men, both in brown suits. It was impossible to keep track of them, except that one was a little less ugly than the other. She remembered what Brian did. She remembered so well that she could play the scene, stop it, rewind it, play it again like a video. She had the gun centered on the flat of her palm, like on a plate or a tray. In her memory, it looked like someone else's hand. But she could feel the weight of the gun there when she really thought about it, so she knew it was her own. She wasn't pointing it. She was simply holding it, observing it. It was dead, inanimate. But firing it would make it come alive. Peter put his hands to his hair when he saw it, and she wondered if that movement was written into his genetic code or whether he'd learned the gesture from being around Brian his whole life. "Mom," Peter said, calmly, bravely, and looked to his father for help. But Brian said not one single word. Instead, he turned around and walked upstairs. That's the part she could play for herself, for a lawyer, for a doctor, at any hour of the day or night, no matter what medication she was taking, no matter what sort of week she was having. If only they could hook up a cord to her brain and see it for themselves. Anne knew what he was hoping for. She knew exactly what he was hoping for. And he didn't even have the basic decency to take Peter upstairs with him. So Peter went charging out the door to the Gleasons to get help. After 2 hours of waiting in the chilly dusk, she could no longer deny that she had to use the bathroom. There was a Dunkin' Donuts on the corner. Murphy's Law was that he'd pass by just as she closed the restroom door, but she had to go, and it couldn't be helped. After her long vigil, she was stiff getting out of the car, but she walked briskly to the corner, entered the store, bought a small black coffee just so the woman behind the counter would hand over the key, which was attached to a ping-pong paddle. The small place filled in just the short length of time Anne was in the bathroom. At the counter was an NYPD patrolman with his back to her, and next to him, a young woman dressed like a schoolboy of some kind. A dark wig cut short under a red beret, glasses with thick black frames. Behind them was a person dressed as a cookie, and just after that person, milk, bacon and eggs, Wonder Woman, Bill and Hillary Clinton. The falling evening had an edge to it, the temperature dropping quickly. Outside on the sidewalk, Pippi Longstocking walked hand in hand with the Cat in the Hat. The girl, schoolboy, had one tendril of dark blonde hair dangling from the back of the wig, and when she and the patrolman turned, Anne stepped back to let them pass in the tight space. The young woman passed Anne first, and then the patrolman, and as they passed, the coarse fabric of the young man's uniform jacket brushed Anne's hand, and she felt a shiver. She held the ping-pong paddle before her, like a shield. At the door, the girl, dressed as a boy, turned around to say something to the cop, and as she was speaking, she looked at Anne, briefly, without really seeing. But then she turned slowly back. The cop was holding the door for her, but still, she stopped, took off her costume glasses, and held Anne's gaze across a room full of people, the leaves skittering along the pavement outside. Kate Gleason, Anne thought, the syllables of the girl's name banging around inside her head like a gong. Jesus Christ, she said aloud, and then she looked hard at the patrolman next to Kate. It was like looking at Brian Stanhope in the year 1973.
"You okay, lady?"
Bill Clinton asked, tugging up the bottom half of his mask.
"You good?"
Anne nodded, stepped around him so that she wouldn't lose track of Kate and Peter. This wasn't what she'd pictured. Maybe they only ran into each other an hour earlier. Maybe it was all one great coincidence. Maybe there was a St. Bart's reunion in the city and they'd included Peter. But behind these thin possibilities, she felt a great turbine moving. Anne waited for him to turn and see her too, and when he did, and despite Kate, she'd make herself say what she wanted to say, and he could take it or leave it, but the point was to have come, and if he wanted to see her again or not was totally up to him. But she hoped he'd want to. That was the point, after all, not just to check on him, but to talk with him, to be in his life again, no matter what. She was so much better now, and they had time to make up, yes, but it wasn't impossible. Nothing was impossible. If she had to, she'd apologize to the girl, too, for hurting her father like that. It was an accident. He'd accidentally come to their door at the worst possible time. But when Kate turned her gaze away, she didn't signal Peter, like Anne expected her to. She just stepped through the door behind him, and together they walked off into the falling night. 2 hours later, going 80 miles per hour, almost back in Saratoga after having made a series of blind turns and somehow finding the highway, she realized two things. First, that Peter's costume might not have been a costume. And second, that she was clutching between her thighs a filthy ping-pong paddle, a bathroom key. 13. Here was the thing he couldn't say to Lena, but that he knew was true. That thing leading men say to their long-suffering women while the audience sits in a dark theater thinking, "This asshole, don't you fall for that bullshit, honey. You're too good for him." But it was true, Francis thought now. Whatever happened between him and Joan had nothing to do with Lena, and it meant nothing to him. He'd started it, he knew, if he was really being honest. There'd been that morning, after Kate's party, holding her sandals like a teenager, a moment like a live wire he'd touched, and then couldn't let go. He thought about it for weeks after, almost non-stop, the surprise of it coming then of all times in his life, after the wreck of his face, the certainty of what had been exchanged between them without either of them saying a word. But he didn't see her for months and months and months, and there was no harm in thinking about a thing as long as he didn't act. Once, around Halloween that same year, Joan's name was listed along with several others as one of the women who'd collected signatures for a new candidate running for county executive, and seeing her name had given him a charge like she was standing in the room. And then he saw her at the Christmas carnival. Lena was working a baked goods booth to raise money for St. Bart's, and had asked him twice if he was okay to wander, if he was okay with a late supper, since she'd probably need to help pack up the booth at the end, if he was okay without his walking stick. He'd spotted his stick leaning by the door when they left the house, but he hadn't had any dizzy spells in several months, so he ignored it. He knew she was dying to suggest he take it, just in case. Dark would come quickly, after all, and the leaves on the ground were slick. But she was sensitive to everything he felt and knew he didn't like using it, didn't even like when she suggested he needed it. Once Lena was settled in her booth, he walked up the road and watched for a few minutes as the Dance Academy students filed out of the studio to do a routine on the street, the little ones with tummies pushing out their leotards, their baby skin goose-fleshed in the cold, and he thought they should have jackets on. He sampled 4 Dixie cups of chili and then wrote his vote on an index card and dropped it in a box. He stopped by one of the contractor booths, chatted with a retired cop who sold and installed vinyl siding now and was there trying to drum up new business. Francis got caught up on every shared acquaintance from the 4-1 to the 2-6. "You don't see anybody?" the other cop asked Francis tentatively. "I thought with everything... Wasn't there a group from the 4-1 who visited regular?" There were 3 guys who came to the hospital a few times, and then a few times after he came home. Lena had set him up on the couch for these visits because he didn't want them in his bedroom. They stood around in their sport coats, having no idea what to do or say. "Yeah, they do, of course. They're great about that. Everyone's busy, you know?" The other man told a long story about his kids, varsity baseball, a controversy about who got picked to start. "You have girls," the other man concluded. "You're lucky you don't have to deal with this stuff." Francis agreed, because it was easy, but thought, "My Kate is a better athlete than all of your boys combined." Close to the firehouse, where Santa was giving out coloring books on fire safety, he saw her. She was sipping a drink she was holding between mittened hands. She saw him just a second later and glanced over her shoulder as if looking for a place to hide. When he got closer, instead of saying hello, she just began talking. "Right now you're thinking, there's a woman who should not be drinking."
"I'm not,"
he said, hearing once again that thing in his voice that had made him self-conscious at Kate's party. Warm, full of fun. He wasn't always. He blew into his cupped hands, said it was good to see her, and then could think of absolutely nothing else to say, so he blew into his hands again. "You're freezing," she said. "You want to go in?" They were in front of a new bar, 2 bartenders outside ladling mulled wine out of a crock pot and selling it for $3 per styrofoam cup. Inside, no one took notice of Francis Gleason taking a bar stool with a woman who was not his wife, because that was the sort of day it was. And people knew him. They knew Joan. If there were anything amiss, they wouldn't be having a drink in the middle of town with Lena Gleason just 100 yards up the road. It was very crowded inside, thanks to the unexpected cold of the day, but there were 2 bar stools near the back, as if waiting for them. Later, Francis thought of all the things that would have stopped him, would have been too much. If he'd seen Oscar Maldonado, who mentioned several days later that he'd seen him there, asked what he thought of the place. Or, if Joan had told him that her ex-husband had finally signed the divorce papers earlier that week, that the warmed wine she'd been sipping outside was the first chance she'd had to celebrate. But she didn't tell him that until later. If Lena had told him before they parted ways that she didn't feel great, thought she might have a low-grade fever, had taken an aspirin before walking with him into town, that it just didn't seem to be working... It was unlike Lena to not feel well, and had he known before the festival instead of after, he probably would have stayed with her at her booth to help. What did they talk about for that hour and a half? They were so warmed up after just a few minutes that they had to take off their coats and scarves, pile them on their laps because the stools didn't have backs. Lena would never let him sit on a stool without a back. What if he lost his balance? Frances noticed how close Joan's knee was to his, the line of her clavicle where her blouse was a little askew. He asked about her work, and when he asked the same question twice, she laughed, dipping her chin to her chest like she was trying to hide it from him. And when she looked at him again, it was as if she knew every thought he'd ever had. It was easy, and that surprised him. He felt young and strong and completely unconnected to the person Lena had been fussing over for so many years. Joan was frank about it, which helped, at first. Later, it was her frankness that made him most disgusted with himself. "I live in the Hilltop Apartments now," she said, "renting until my settlement." She touched his elbow. She tapped her index finger on his forearm, just once, so quickly he thought he might have imagined it, except that he could feel his pulse beating there. But then she was gathering her coat, her mittens. A short walk, a turn, another short walk. His heart was beating so loudly he thought surely she would hear. The noise of the festival disguised the direction of their footsteps. Mid-December, the gloaming came early, the sky going orange and then a bruised purple and then dark gray. She pushed through the front door to the lobby, and they stood side by side without looking at each other, without speaking, until the elevator arrived. "What are we doing?" he asked, once they were inside, but Joan only looked at him and smiled, opened her cabinets to find glasses. She switched on the TV and turned the volume low. No point pretending now, though he was shaking like a schoolboy. His hand passed over his eye. He had a new prosthetic as of that month, hand-painted by a ludicrously expensive ocular artist in Connecticut, and the girls were floored by how good, how real it looked. Worth every penny, Lena had said, though they hadn't paid all the pennies yet. The day they paid off this one single eyeball would be the day he decided whether it had been worth it. But he did like talking to people again like he once had, not having to pretend he didn't notice them studying his face, their eyes darting back and forth as they tried not to stare at his old prosthesis, which had been so uncomfortable and so false in appearance that Kate told him the patch looked better. He'd gotten so used to the patch that his face felt naked now. She put her hands on either side of his neck, cold despite the mittens, running them in perfect symmetry across his shoulders, down his arms. He shivered and fitted his hands on either side of her waist like he had early that morning in May, 7 months before. It had nothing to do with Lena, whom he loved as much as he did the day they married. It only had to do with him and the things he wanted, and the things he missed about himself, the things he missed feeling. Whatever had happened with Joan, whatever would happen, again, he hoped, could exist entirely apart from his life with Lena, couldn't it? And yet, just an hour after stepping over the threshold to Joan's apartment, when he hurried back down to the sidewalk and approached the festival from the southern end, as if he'd only taken a little walk over to the duck pond, and saw Lena waiting for him on the double yellow, the detritus of the festival scattered around her, the naked fear on her face, he wondered if, in fact, it did have something to do with her. He'd been a good cop, a good husband, a good father. He'd been great, actually, at all of those things, and it didn't feel immodest for him to think so. But then, through no fault of his own, because he was good, because he was responsible and dependable, he'd gone to his neighbor's front door and been blasted into a new reality, one where he wasn't a cop at all, wasn't a good husband, apparently. Was he still a good father? He hoped so, but as of the last hour, he had his doubts. "People said there's black ice near the firehouse," Lena said. "They said someone slipped and fell." She delivered her worry like an accusation. "I'm fine," he said, taking her bags from her. Her tablecloth, the trays she'd taken from home for the displays. "People spilled drinks. They don't realize how quickly it freezes up weather like this." And then, "Are you okay?" Lena, for the love of God, please stop asking me if I'm okay. Just stop. He sounded angrier than he felt. I went to the new bar. I ran into a lot of people. Sorry, Lena said, chastened. She touched her fingertips to her temples. I just don't feel very well. I thought it was a cold, but maybe it's the flu. Francis met Joan twice more after that, twice more over the course of 10 days. They met at her apartment again, and the last time was at a park, a little upstate where Lena didn't like to bring him because she thought the walking path wasn't even enough, that he risked tripping on a cracked paver or a root. He took the bus to a strip mall in Riverside, and from there Joan picked him up. He pressed her slim body against the concrete wall of the park's restroom, closed for the season. She suggested they go to the Holiday Inn on Route 12, stay for a couple of hours, and then she made fun of him for seeming shocked.
What? She laughed. My treat. It's not the plaza.
But at the front desk, he waved her money away, mortified. He put down his credit card. Do you want me to drive? He asked later, when they got back to her car, and just like that, she handed over the keys. He drove to her place, and from there he walked to Jefferson. At that point, he hadn't driven a car in over 4 years. Just sliding behind the wheel made him feel younger, more like himself than he'd been since the accident. And Joan didn't seem the least bit worried about being his passenger. Merging onto the throughway, glancing left over his shoulder, he got disoriented for a second. But almost as soon as he looked straight ahead again, it was fine. On the day he was planning to see Joan for a fourth time, Lena stayed home from work because she couldn't shake that same cold she'd felt coming on the day of the fair, made a doctor's appointment, asked Francis if he wanted to come along. She didn't need him in the room with her, nothing like that. It was just that the doctor's office was near the hardware store, and maybe he wanted to browse. They hadn't been down that way in a little while. There was no opportunity to call Joan, so he hoped when he didn't show up that she'd figure it out. That day, just after Lena's appointment, they were sitting at a window booth at the Gillum Diner, when Lena asked if it was possible a person could give herself cancer. The doctor took a chest x-ray, diagnosed bronchitis, said she needed rest. Can a person give herself cancer just from worrying about things? Stress? She looked off toward some distant point out the window. She'd read a book about it, she said. Francis couldn't remember how he'd responded, but when he thought back on that moment, the sun on the window, the film of oil floating on top of their coffee cups, the bustle of the waitstaff and customers all around them, he imagined a small, dry seed falling through Lena's body and landing somewhere near her left lung. He imagined the seed growing fat on Lena's warm center, a sprout pushing through soft tissue, wrapping itself around and around. He imagined all of this happening while he stared at his plate and thought about Joan Cavanaugh, the way her long red hair looked against the white of her narrow back. You knew already, he said when she finally told him. You knew and you didn't tell me. He was angry with her. He was angry with himself. He wanted to comfort her, but instead he crossed his arms and stepped away. The doctor had diagnosed bronchitis, yes, but he'd also noticed something else and had ordered more tests. She apologized when she gave him the news, and he couldn't get himself to say what he was supposed to say, which was, of course, it wasn't her fault, and they'd get through it, and it would all be okay. But was it her fault? When had she first had an odd feeling in her chest? According to the doctor, it could have been several months earlier. When she said she had no symptoms, the doctor said it was just that she hadn't noticed them. Some people are more tuned into their bodies than others. When Frances caught her coughing on her way to the bedroom, her hand on the wall to steady herself, he stood at the bottom of the stairs and told her he thought she was smarter than that. Why in the world had she waited so long to go to the doctor? And even when she sat down on the step and cried, he found he could not go to her or say any of the things that would make her feel better. You're going to be fine, Lena, he said eventually, her at the top of the stairs, him at the bottom. It was an order. He once had a dozen men in his command. The girls came home the night before her surgery to help her get ready. "Lena," he whispered into her hair that morning, the house still sound asleep. She'd set her alarm for 6 a.m., but it hadn't gone off, and now they'd need to rush. "Lena, love," he said, and drew her closer to him, told her he was sorry about the way he'd been acting. He was just so shocked, and he couldn't lose her. It was something that absolutely could not happen. She reached behind and found his hip, squeezed, told him she knew all that, of course, that it was all going to be okay, that he would see. He got dressed quickly, and while the girls bustled around, Sarah and Natalie cross-checked the contents of Lena's bag with the list the doctor's assistant had provided them. Kate offered to go into the shower with her, to help wash her with a special surgical soap. Lena had laughed. "Oh, honey," she'd said. He realized he had a little time to kill before they had to leave for the hospital. Without telling any of them that he was stepping out, he walked down to the deli like he did most mornings for his coffee and a paper. Something about sticking to his routine was soothing, and as he watched his breath in the cold air, he began to feel for the first time that all would be well. His face hurt. His body was not in synchrony, but it felt temporary. The doctors would do their mysterious work, and she'd suffer, no doubt, but she was strong, and in the end it would be fine. And when he turned the corner onto Main Street, there was Joan Cavanaugh in her blue coat, her long hair brassy in the sunlight, looking at him coming like she'd known him long enough for him to hurt her. But she hadn't known him long enough to earn that look, and he hadn't known her long enough to feel anything other than shame. He thought of his mother for the first time in a very long time. He thought of his father. The two of them, dead and buried, gone 25 years. Neither of them able to fathom America beyond the little bit of it they'd seen together when Francis was an infant. Neither of them capable even of half-baked promises to visit, one day, like other old-timers sometimes said to make it all easier. Neither of them capable of lying in any way, not even when a lie would be merciful. "Sure, I'll be back to visit in no time," Francis had said that day when they clutched him in the threshold of the cottage, and his mother pressed her dry cheek to his over and over again. "Ara, why would you?" his father had said. His father told him that in New York City there were bakeries galore and he'd have to take care not to get fat. It was his single piece of advice. They'd not warned him about money or women or drinking or fighting because Francis was a good boy, a sound young man, with a good head on his shoulders. If they were looking down on him now, from heaven, they might not even recognize him. Francis had not seen Joan since that afternoon at the Holiday Inn. He hadn't returned her calls since Lena's diagnosis. It was a Monday morning. Surgery was scheduled for 11, but Lena had to report to the hospital by 9. It was early still, just after 7, and construction workers passed Joan by, rushing in and out the door that jangled with every swing. She kept her eyes on Francis as he approached. Local cops left their cruisers in the no-parking zone, ran in for coffee. Excuse me, good morning," they said as they passed. 1, 2, 3. He remembered being a cop once, jogging upstairs, steering his vehicle down city streets, the heady pleasure of knowing he was about to stop a bad thing from happening, the crushing disappointment when he arrived just a few minutes too late. On that particular morning, a frigid cold day in late January, Lena whispering her prayers at home, Kate on break from her first year of college, far too young to lose her mother, Francis remembered settling a 1052 in the 2-6 by calling each party into the fifth floor hall of their building, one at a time, and asking each one if they loved the other, and if so, could they please stop throwing things at each other. To please stop waking the neighbors. After that, the guys called him Lieutenant Love for a while. Once, Joan called the house when she thought Lena was at work, but Lena answered. Francis stood outside their bedroom door listening to their conversation, with his fists clenched so tight he got a cramp in his forearms.
Joan Kavanaugh, Lena said when she hung up, a question mark in her tone. Casey wants Kate's address at school for something, a reunion of some kind. And then, I think she was drunk, to be honest.
Francis had murmured signs of interest and then stepped into the bathroom. He studied his face in the mirror and saw that the old scar tissue was livid and sore-looking.
I heard about Lena, Joan said outside the deli that morning when he was close enough to hear her.
Hearing Lena's name in her mouth would be part of his punishment, too, he supposed. She didn't have the right to say her name, but it was his fault she didn't see it that way.
What happens now?
She asked, and looked at him like she deserved an answer. How to say what he needed to say without making everything worse? So he said nothing at all. He brushed by her like the construction workers had, like the cops had, and he got his cup of coffee, tucked his paper under his arm.
She drove by him, slowly, just a minute or so later, and called him all the things he already knew he was. A coward, a cheat, a prick. He could have crossed to the other side of the street, where he wouldn't be able to hear her as well, but he stayed where he was.
Every name she called him was true. She followed him and shouted the words until he turned onto Madison. In the hospital, Sarah and Natalie wandered in and out of the waiting room. They fetched coffees and sandwiches that none of them ate. They took walks down the long hallways to stretch their legs. Kate stood rooted to her spot next to Francis. The surgery seemed to go on forever, and different surgeons were coming out to the waiting room to reassure other families.
Katie, Francis said, pulling her toward his chest like he hadn't done since she was little.
Kate assured him it was all normal. The surgeon had explained to them what had to be done and had given them a time frame they were still within. She said his own surgery, which of course he didn't remember, had gone several hours longer than they'd been told it would, and just like that he saw Lena in his place, himself on the table in the OR, and understood why she'd never managed to let go of that baseline worry.
Dad, Kate said, it's not the right time, maybe, but I have to tell you something.
Francis was grateful for the distraction despite a pang of dread. He was relieved to look away from the clock for a moment.
If she was about to tell him she was pregnant, he'd be disappointed, but he wouldn't tell her what to do. If she'd flunked out of school, he'd be surprised, but it would be okay to have her home again for a little while until she figured herself out. Whatever it was wasn't the end of the world, and he'd tell her so. All that mattered was getting Lena healthy again.
He studied her, his lovely girl, her hair so shiny under the fluorescent lights.
I got a letter from Peter, she said. It was mailed home. Mom kind of figured who it was from, but she forwarded it to me at school. She said I should tell you, but I never found the right moment.
He removed his arm from around her shoulder.
You got a letter from Peter Stanhope? He repeated.
Saying what?
Kate looked off, shrugged. Just stuff we used to talk about. So I wrote back. Now we email sometimes. He wants to see me. I told Mom already, and she said I had to tell you.
Kate hesitated.
He's doing very well. He got a full scholarship to a college in New Jersey.
Francis had been standing, but now he sat. Sarah and Nat would be back any moment.
I'd like to meet up with him once Mom feels better. We were best friends for so long. I'd just like to see him, see how he is. We'd meet in the city, just for closure, I promise. You have to understand. Everything happened at once, and then all of a sudden he was gone.
Closure. That was a word she'd learned in college, no doubt. Did he have closure when he left Ireland at her age and never returned?
Are you going to say something?
It had been some time by then since he heard from his lawyer that Anne Stanhope had been moved upstate. No one had heard a thing about Brian in a very long time, not even on the job. Though he supposed the pension checks must be mailed somewhere. What did Peter want with Kate?
It's harmless, Kate ventured.
Look at me, Francis said. You know what I'd be right now? If Anne Stanhope hadn't shot me? I'd be a captain. Higher, maybe. No doubt about it. I had a bad feeling about her from the get-go, and I have a bad feeling about him. I should have listened to your mother. I should have let the local cops arrive, and I should have let them handle it. I should have sent Peter home to wait on his own porch.
Last you saw him, he was only 14. That's not fair.
Life isn't fair, Kate. I don't want you seeing him. Period.
You can't treat me like a kid anymore, Dad.
It was so absurd that Francis had to laugh, despite the circumstances.
Oh, Kate, he said.
Lena made it through surgery. She made it through chemo and radiation. He cooked for them, and when she was weak, he spoon-fed her like he used to feed the girls if Lena was too busy. A few times when she fell asleep on the couch downstairs, he lifted her in his arms, her body so light it felt hollow, and brought her up to their room. He didn't get dizzy. He didn't wobble. Hour to hour, day to day, he kept his head down and thought about what she might need next. The first time he packed her into the passenger seat of their car and settled in behind the wheel, she'd glanced at him like she might protest, but then just decided to let it happen. She lost every hair on her body, and when it began to grow back, she looked like a baby bird. She didn't bother with a wig or with scarves. When she was chilly, she pulled one of the girls' old hats over her head. When she felt strong enough to walk outside, she leaned on him. And once, she had to sit on the curb and wait while he hurried back home to get the car, and then drove around the block to pick her up. Finally, spring came. Lena on the mend. Both of them were sure they were through the worst, that all that was left was recovery. Kate would soon be finished with her first year of college. Francis said to Lena across the silence of the kitchen, "We could go to the nursery today. If you want, see about getting some annuals. We could plant them this weekend." Lena was sipping tea at the table. The kettle poured steam from its spout.
"Francis," Lena said, "did something happen between you and Joan Kavanaugh? Over the winter?"
Her expression was so calm, so peaceful. It was as if she were merely curious, as if the answer didn't matter to her either way. She wore a half-smile, as if to reassure him, as if she knew this would be hard for him. He gripped the counter, closed his eyes. All the blood in his body rushed to his face.
"I thought so," Lena said.
When he had the courage to look at her, he saw that she was crying, with her hand clapped over her mouth.
"The thing is," she said plainly, matter-of-factly, "in a million years, no matter what, I never, ever would have done that to you."
And Francis knew that was the truth.
It took him a while to figure it out, and every time he realized he was trying to figure it out, he chastised himself, as if it mattered. The credit card bill, maybe. Maybe they'd been seen. It was reckless to drive Joan's car through town with her in it, to drive right up to her building. But it was Casey Kavanaugh who told Kate, who told her sisters, who told their mother. Casey had called Kate in a rage, angry on her mother's behalf, angry at Kate's perfect little family that the whole town adored just because her busybody father had stuck his nose in where it didn't belong and got shot. The word busybody attached to her father struck Kate as funny, and it took her a second to comprehend what Casey was yelling into the phone. A busybody was a woman, for a start. A certain type of highly strung, advanced, middle-aged woman. Not her near-silent father, who'd only gone next door that night because he was brave, and he was trained, and it was the right thing to do. What was Casey going on about? Kate didn't believe it until, at Natalie's insistence, they spoke to their mother about it. How crazy it was.
that this was some strange rumor she might encounter around town, and they didn't want her to be caught up short. Instead of being horrified, instead of being shocked, Lena remembered the odd phone call that one night. And there was that afternoon when she'd called the house from work and let it ring and ring and ring, hoping to tell him to turn on the crock pot, which was filled with ingredients, but which she was almost certain she'd forgotten to turn on. Later, when she asked what he'd gotten up to that day, he said he hadn't done a thing.
"Mom," Sarah said, "you have to kick him out. Don't stand for it."
Natalie said the same. Kate was angry at the three of them for believing it all so readily. Surely there was an explanation.
"Girls," Lena said, "it's between me and your father."
The girls came home for Mother's Day, and Frances planted the flowers before they arrived. Sarah and Natalie mostly avoided him, but Kate kept her eyes on him, followed him out to the shed later that afternoon to confront him.
"Did you really do what Casey said?"
He could have lied to her then, and she would have believed it. She was desperate to believe anything that might take the place of the truth. He hung the hedge clippers on the hook. He threw the little hand rake in the gardening bin.
"It's between me and Mom," he said, without looking at her.
"It's so disgusting, it makes me want to throw up," she said, and took a step toward him like she might shove him.
"How could you? Do you know how she took care of you? How could you hurt her like that?"
"I don't know."
It was the truth.
"You don't know?"
Her voice was thick with fury.
"You don't know,"
she repeated. She turned back to the house and seemed about to walk off, but all of a sudden she turned back.
"I'm seeing Peter. We visited each other at school. I love him. I felt bad about that, but now I don't."
She studied him to see how that went over.
"He would never do that to me, what you did to Mom."
And suddenly Frances was the one who was furious. He had never hit any of his girls, but his hand itched to smack her face.
"Kate, please, grow up, will you?"
"And guess what else? Mom knows. Mom doesn't mind."
"Sure."
"It's true. Ask her." "Oh, what's that? Are you hurt that she kept something from you? That she did something behind your back?"
The next afternoon, when the girls finally boarded the bus to the city, Frances went up to Kate's bedroom, where Lena was resting. He didn't know if she wanted him to come into the room, so he stood awkwardly at the door and told her what Kate had said and asked whether it was true that she knew.
"It won't come to anything, probably," Lena said, not looking at him, running her fingers along the pattern of Kate's childhood quilt.
"She said she loves him."
"I warned her. I told her love only helps up to a point, but the more we object, the more determined she'll be."
Frances felt a shiver of fear pass through him.
"But after all I went through, how could she be so dumb? This kid? Why?"
"She won't listen to me, so you have to tell her. We never made her feel bad about sneaking out that night."
Lena looked directly at him then for the first time in several days.
"You blame her?"
"No, of course not."
They were so young still. Maybe it would fizzle out. Lena, he saw, was happy that Kate had someone to love, and that it was Peter was somewhat beside the point. She loved so easily and so fully. Maybe Kate was the same. Lena had told him that she loved him before he said it to her. In those days, that was unusual and had shocked Frances. They were walking along the sidewalk in Bay Ridge, and he'd stopped to kiss her, their cold noses brushing up against one another. She wasn't looking for him to say it back. She was just letting him know that her love was his to keep or to fritter away.
"Lena,"
Frances said. He walked up to the edge of the bed, having no idea what he wanted to say.
"I..."
But Lena was like a fist that could not be pried open. She gathered the covers and drew them up to her throat. She shrank back against the wall.
It'll all be okay soon, Francis. But not yet.
14. By Peter's senior year at Elliott, the guys on the team came to him instead of going to Coach. Coach was angling for a Division I job in Pennsylvania and was often distracted, so it was Peter who told them where they should be pacing, what distances they should be covering in practice. Peter moved runners around, switching lifelong two-milers to the 1,500-meter, holding brief but pointed meetings with them on the bleachers that overlooked the track as if that were his private office. They were awkward kids, mostly, who'd walked onto their high school cross-country or track teams because they'd failed at other sports. Running was straightforward. Going fast for a long time was the hard part, and most of them left that to Peter and the handful of other kids who'd been recruited. One guy, who was a middle-distance walk-on, took a hurdle for fun after practice one day, and Peter saw that he'd be perfect for steeplechase. He mentioned all these changes to Coach as if they were mere suggestions, and then told Coach to watch, see if he didn't see what Peter saw. Next meet, the changes would be in the books. The team got better. After every solid race, the runner would pick his head up and search the crowd for Peter. Coach said Peter could spend less time analyzing his teammates and more time analyzing himself. How could Peter improve if every chance he got, he was on the bus to New York to see his girlfriend? And another thing, Pete, Coach said. Your sweat smells 80 proof, at least. Cool it, maybe, okay? Kate was exactly the same, and also completely different. When she walked into the bar that night, the first time they met up, she raised her eyebrows just like she did the day their seventh-grade teacher announced the first pop quiz of the year, and the floodwaters of their long history together rose quickly around him. Later, she confessed that she'd almost not come. Her mother was about to start chemotherapy. Her father had outright forbidden it. Plus, she was so nervous. She'd changed clothes at least 10 times, and in the end, borrowed an outfit from her roommate. He was mostly through a pint of beer by the time she got to the bar, and when he stood from the table and walked around to hug her, neither of them had any idea what to say. He'd gotten there a full hour early, and after circling the block to kill time, he stopped into a different bar and had 2 shots of Jameson, one after another, snapping his head back like he used to see his father do, followed by a Jack and Coke he sipped slowly. It didn't help, at first. His nerves felt like spiders crawling under his skin. But then, back on the sidewalk, heading to their meeting point, he gradually felt steadier, calmer, less worried. Peter, Kate said, standing back from him a little and looking at his face. I can't believe it. The ends of her hair were dyed purple. Her nail polish was black and mostly bitten away. Her long, slender fingers were covered in thick silver rings, and she was wearing Doc Martens that laced to her knees. But her face was the same. Bright eyes, that impish smirk. He studied her mouth when she spoke. I'm glad you wrote, Kate said once they sat, as if she hadn't already said that very thing in the dozen letters and emails that had been exchanged between them. It was nearly spring break for both of them. Peter had already taken 2 midterms and had only 2 papers to hand in before he headed back to Queens for the week. Kate had her first midterm coming up. So? She grinned. How was high school? They visited each other often and spoke on the phone almost every day. They tended not to discuss Gillum or their parents or anything that might brush up against what had happened between their families in May of 8th grade. Although each of them had looked different back in 8th grade, there was a feeling of returning to the familiar, to what had always been theirs. Peter had always had a pair of freckles on his neck that looked like a vampire bite. The freckles were the same, but the neck was different. Thicker, stronger, rough with stubble. Each had long, lean torsos, though Kate's dipped in at the waist, while Peter's was as straight and solid as the trunk of an oak. Kate had a splatter of freckles across her nose and her shoulders, but beneath her clothes she was milky white. Peter's neck, face, and forearms were dark brown from running outside in a t-shirt. when she discovered he had chest hair under his shirt and a soft, dark trail that ran down the center of his belly, she pulled back for a moment, embarrassed. And then there were the things that surprised her and how moved she felt just by seeing them. The sight of his yogurt next to her orange juice in her mini-fridge. His boxers on the floor next to her bra. Once, she began to pull on his jeans because she thought they were hers. And when she realized, she wondered if she'd ever been so happy in her entire life. They had only one disagreement that spring. Kate was talking about her father, how he'd hurt her mother by having an affair, how it was the biggest mistake of his life, including the night he went up to the Stanhope's door. But Peter had no reaction.
"I hope you don't feel guilty," Kate asked, trying to account for his blankness.
"Guilty? No. I was just thinking that there were so many victims that night. Your father, your mother, my mother." Kate drew back to look at him sharply.
"Your mother was a victim?"
"Well, yes," Peter said slowly, deliberately.
"Are you serious?"
"Yes, of course I'm serious."
"Explain that to me,"
Kate said, arms akimbo. "She was obviously sick, Kate. As far as I know, she's still in the hospital. If she'd just gotten the right medicine from the beginning..."
Kate held up her hand like a stop sign. "Actually, don't explain it to me. I think we're going to have to be at peace with disagreeing about this."
"But then..."
"She's definitely still in the hospital. My father's lawyer would have called us if she'd been released."
"Oh," Peter said, the information as sudden as a slap.
"Because of what she did to him, they're responsible for letting him know if there's a change in her status."
"Yeah, I got that. Thanks."
He paused.
"But it's not like she did it to him, in the sense that she had a thing against him in particular. He was just the person who came to the door. Why would they notify him of a change in her status? Like she might go after him again?"
"She shot him because she hated me. My mother told me that."
Peter was so incredulous he had to swallow back a laugh. "It's quite a bit more complicated than that, Kate."
"Do you want to see her? Is that it? I thought when you said you weren't in touch, that meant your relationship was over."
"She's my mother."
"And?"
"No, I don't want to see her."
He checked himself as he said it, but it seemed true. Just thinking about walking into a room where she was felt like inviting chaos back into his life. "Peter?" Kate said, bringing her fingers to her temples as if trying to block out static. "Can you imagine what it was like for us? When my father was in the hospital? When we worried about his brain? My mother cut up his food for him. She washed him and dressed him."
"I'm sure it was awful. What are we arguing about?"
"And no word from you. Not a single word. I chose a college in New York City partly because that's where I figured you'd gone. You mentioned Queens that night, do you remember? But you could have found me whenever you wanted to. I was exactly where I'd always been. Why didn't you?"
"But I did," he said meekly.
"You scribbled a letter on a whim and mailed it to me 4.5 years later." But Peter could no better explain that than he could explain his feelings for Kate to guys on the Dutch Kills track team. It made sense in his heart and in his gut, but to his brain the logic was incoherent. They were walking along Broadway, and Kate had sped up, was standing with her arms around herself in front of a display window. Broadway chocolatier. Tuesday night wine pairings. Thursday night truffle-making classes. Her profile was made of stone.
"You're right. I should have contacted you earlier. It's like I said in my first letter. I kept thinking I would, and then time passed, and I was afraid you hated me. I thought about you all the time. I don't know why I didn't write sooner. I think..."
"What?"
"It was a lot. I was worried about my mom, then my dad left. Then I worried I was imposing on my uncle. I took each day as it came and didn't look forward or back too often because it would have been too much.
I kept thinking I'd write to you once I got settled, but then I never got settled.
She stood still, without looking at him, for a long time.
I don't want to talk about it anymore,
she said finally.
Okay, he said.
Neither of them felt like a normal college couple, or even like normal college students, but they acted the part. Kate said late one night, after smoking half a pack of cigarettes and vomiting all over the steps of Peter's dorm, that they'd already gone through all the heavy stuff couples go through, so why not enjoy the light stuff now? Peter agreed. It was time to have fun. And he'd figured out that the fun was often not the thing itself, the party, the keg stand, the naked running into the duck pond, but the endless talking about it after, the reliving and describing, and laughing about it in front of people who wished they'd been there. Used to be he was one of the kids listening, one of the kids who missed everything. But now, since college, since Kate, he was in the stories. One day, he'd have to work. One day, he'd have to decide whether he ever wanted to see his parents again. But until college was over, he copied what everyone else did. When a central worry rose up in him, it was impossible to smother his nature entirely. He called up some friends and asked who was free, who wanted to meet up. They headed to football games and tailgates and dorm parties when Kate visited Elliot. When Peter went to NYU, they went to bars and clubs with groups of other college students and ended every night out at the diner on